consumption has been on the rise in recent decades, and much of that sweetness has been added to the food we eat, from tomato sauces and salad dressings to chips. Our guest neuroendocrinologist Robert Lustig says that all that sugar is dangerous, implicated in the growing number of chronic diseases, including heart disease, cancer, and diabetes. He's one of the authors of The Toxic Truth About Sugar, written with Laura Schmidt and Claire Brindis, published in the science journal Nature. They call for taxing sugar products, getting sugary drinks and junk food out of schools, and treating sugar more like alcohol and tobacco. As I said, Robert Lustig is a neuroendocrinologist. He's also an obesity researcher, professor of clinical pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology, and director of the WAY Assessment for Teen and Child Health Program at the University of California in San Francisco. And Robert Lustig, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty. My pleasure.
Well, and let's begin with just the amount of sugar that people are eating. And you write in this article, the consumption of sugar has tripled in the last 50 years. Tripled around the world?
Tripled around the world. The population has doubled. So basically, in the rest of the world, we're at a 50% increase per person. In America, we are way higher than that. Currently, we are consuming 450 calories of added sugar per day, and that is 22 teaspoons per day. That's average. We used to consume on the order of about 5. So we are way higher.
And this is and what your article is about are these added sugars, sugars that have been added to the processed food that we eat.
That's right. We're not talking about endogenous sugar like fruit. I'm not against fruit.
Right.
I am against juice, and the reason is because of the removal of fiber, which I think is equally as important as the sugar issue. The fiber has been removed very specifically for one reason and one reason only. It's called shelf life. Because you can't freeze fiber. Take an orange, put it in your freezer, take it out the next day, thaw it, try to eat it, see what you get.
Right.
You get mush. And the reason is because the ice crystals macerate the cell wall of the plant, the water rushes in, and that's the end of the food. The food industry knows that, so squeeze it, freeze it, lasts forever, reduces depreciation, reduces price, increases access, all good for the pocketbook, not good for your health.
And we're talking about high fructose corn syrup in many ways.
Well, high fructose corn syrup is what a lot of processed foods use because it's more miscible. It's easier to add to foods because it doesn't go, it doesn't crystallize out of solution. So a lot of the processed food industry has switched to high fructose corn syrup. But ultimately, high fructose corn syrup, sucrose, we're talking basically the same thing. The point is that the amount of added sugar in our diet is just out of control, and our livers can't handle it.
And help us understand then how, because you talk about liver toxicity,
right.
How does a liver try to metabolize all this added sugar?
Right. So, first of all, added sugar, sucrose or high fructose corn syrup, is basically one molecule of glucose, and glucose is important for life. In fact, if you don't consume glucose, your body makes it because it's really important. And one molecule of fructose, and fructose is different from glucose. It is the sweet part of sugar. It's the part we crave, and it's also the part that's causing the problem, causing the peripheral metabolic disease and also the continued consumption. So it's the fructose that we've got the issue with, not the glucose. Bottom line, the glucose gets metabolized to a compound in your liver called glycogen. Glycogen is liver starch, and it is relatively safe. It is non-toxic. In fact, that's why marathoners before a marathon go ahead and carb load, is to try to increase their stores of glycogen to give them more energy for the race. And it doesn't do anybody any harm to increase your glycogen stores.
Right.
The problem is that fructose is not metabolized to glycogen. What it is metabolized to instead is liver fat. And that liver fat has a tendency to muck up the works. It certainly increases your triglyceride levels in your bloodstream, and it can precipitate in the liver, causing this phenomenon called fatty liver. And it turns out that the amount of fat that your liver makes confers how much insulin resistance, which is the primary scientific phenomenon that underlies the issue of metabolic syndrome.
And
metabolic syndrome are all those diseases, type 2 diabetes, hypertension, dyslipidemia, cardiovascular disease, and likely cancer and dementia as well.
And you mentioned the word fat, and we are fat-obsessed in this country, and we also have many obese people. But are you also saying that this fructose creates obesity, makes people fat?
No, I'm not saying that, and actually people have misconstrued what I have said very specifically. You know, I do not say that fructose causes obesity. In fact, a paper that just came out just last week from a group in Toronto, the first author is Stephen Piper, and he and I have agreed to disagree, although on an academic basis. Consumption of fructose in controlled feeding studies, in other words, so that the number of calories are exactly the same, does not cause any more weight gain than does any other carbohydrate. And I agree with that, because ultimately the first law of thermodynamics says that you can't gain more weight than you take in. That is true, and I don't argue with that. The first law is sacrosanct. If I didn't believe in the first law of thermodynamics, you'd have me called a whack job.
I'm not going to do that. Okay.
Right. So I believe that that is true. The question is what kind of weight. And what the data shows is that what fructose does that's very different from glucose is it causes visceral fat and hepatic fat, liver fat. And that's the bad guy in the story in terms of how it causes all of these peripheral metabolic diseases. Subcutaneous fat, you know, the love handle fat, the big butt fat, is not the issue. That just looks ugly.
Well,
but it's not dangerous from a medical standpoint.
Well, that's fascinating. I do want to pick up on that, but I also want to go back to something that you and your co-authors say in this article, which is that, and this is quoting the United Nations, for the first time in human history, chronic non-communicable diseases such as heart disease, cancer, and diabetes, which we've been talking about, pose a greater health burden worldwide than do infectious diseases.
And that's correct.
Yeah, and I circled it, I underlined it, because it seems to me that represents a dramatic change.
Absolutely. And this was well thought out on the part of the World Health Organization and the UN. And, you know, this statement really, I think, changes the paradigm in terms of what's important in this world and how are we going to deal with it. And it's one of the reasons why we published this article in Nature that has gotten so much attention, because we understand that tobacco and alcohol are part of the problem in terms of non-communicable disease around the world. But we regulate those. They are non-essential consumables, and no one needs them, but they exist. We're not going to be able to get rid of them. Prohibition did not work. So we have to ultimately make them less appealing in some fashion, and the only way to do it is to regulate it. Well, guess what? Sugar fulfills all of the same criteria that do tobacco and alcohol. People say, oh, but sugar is necessary for life. No, it's not. Glucose is necessary for life. But there is not one biochemical reaction anywhere in the human body that requires dietary fructose.
But people
do not understand that.
But are you also saying that it is addictive the way smoking can be addictive? And you're talking to an ex-smoker here.
Right. In fact, there are many, many studies. I participated just yesterday in a symposium on food addiction here at in San Francisco at the Commonwealth Club, where we had six obesity and addiction researchers who discussed the data and what's going on and whether or not sugar is indeed addictive. And I will tell you that it does all of the same things that tobacco, alcohol, and any other substance of abuse does in terms of dysregulating the reward center, the nucleus accumbens in the brain that tells you to try to consume more. Does the exact same things. It's not as potent, agreed, but it still does it.
And we're talking about things like dopamine. I mean, that sense of feeling good or some sense of euphoria.
That's right. So the criteria for addiction are tolerance, which means that you need more to get the same effect, withdrawal, which means that when you remove the substance, you get physiological symptoms, and then a whole bunch of psychological dependencies, binging, craving, use despite negative consequences, et cetera. Sugar does all of those.
Let me go back to something, and I'm clearly not a neuroendocrinologist, but you mentioned the fact that, and this article is about all this added sugar or fructose to our diet. But it seems to me that if you add all those sugars, you are adding calories. Are people actually consuming more calories than we did 50 years ago?
Yes, of course. We are all consuming way more calories than before. and ultimately that's one of the things that people try to use as a knock against this argument,
right.
is, well, we're not just consuming more sugar, we're consuming more of everything.
Right.
And indeed we are. I'm not arguing that. But as a percent of our total caloric consumption, sugar is way higher. In fact, we are not consuming more fat, we are consuming less as a percent. We're not consuming more protein, we're consuming the same amount of protein. The one thing we're consuming way more of is carbohydrate, and very specifically, added sugar. We've gone from 4% of our diet as fructose to 12% of our diet as fructose.
And picking up on something you said earlier, what gets implicated is the liver, but also these insulin levels. And that's where a lot of the focus of your research and concern is?
Correct.
How we regulate insulin?
Right. We have a hormone in our body called leptin. Leptin goes from your fat cell to your brain, and it's supposed to tell your brain, hey, I've got enough energy on board, so I don't have to eat so much. I can regulate my food intake properly, and I can burn energy at a normal rate and feel good about it. And leptin is a very potent negative feedback pathway for energy balance. But clearly, in the last 30 years, because of this obesity epidemic, it's become very clear that leptin ain't working. Because if it were working, we wouldn't be obese. And the question is, what's blocking leptin? The leptin levels are going up, so clearly what's happening is the brain isn't seeing it. Our research has shown that insulin, the other hormone that comes from food intake, actually blocks leptin. And that's one of the things that I've spent the last 15 years investigating as a neuroendocrinologist. So if insulin blocks leptin signaling, then anything that makes your insulin go up is going to increase your weight and also increase your food intake. And that is exactly what we're seeing.
Well, that's interesting.
All the substances that we can be consuming, fructose is the most egregious in terms of raising your insulin.
We're about a minute away from our first break here, but it sounds like you're arguing for a more protein-centric diet?
Well, I'm arguing for a real food diet. That's what I'm arguing for. I'm arguing that it's not the food itself. I believe that all food is inherently good.
Mm-hmm.
From an evolutionary and, you know, almost even spiritual standpoint, there is no such thing as a bad food. God wouldn't have done that to us. It wouldn't have put any food on the planet. That would have been a problem. What I do believe is that what we do to the food is the problem. So, as I mentioned before, the addition of sugar, the removal of fiber, that's called food processing. So food is fine. Processed food is not. And unfortunately, pretty much all processed food is laced with sugar.
Well, that's Robert Lustig, our guest today on Radio Times. He is, as I said, a neuroendocrinologist, an obesity researcher, and co-author of a article that appeared recently in the science journal Nature, The Toxic Truth About Sugar. And he and his co-authors call for the regulation of sugar and actually treating sugar more like tobacco and alcohol. What do you think? Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Penn's College of Liberal and Professional Studies supports WHYY and offers an interdisciplinary Master of Environmental Studies program for students who are passionate about clean air, clean water, and a clean earth. Academic work on local and global environmental issues is combined with fieldwork around Philadelphia and around the world. Details about pursuing your passion for the environment at Penn can be found online by searching Penn MES. Penn's College of Liberal and Professional Studies.
The Discover Newsworks Discover the Philadelphia Region sweepstakes. Newsworks.org is giving away great prizes to our Facebook fans. This week, 6 tickets to 1812 Productions, Philly's all-comedy theater company. Search Newsworks.org on Facebook and enter weekly. Share with your friends for extra chances to win. You must like Newsworks.org on Facebook to enter. No purchase necessary. For a complete list of rules, go to Newsworks.org. Newsworks.org, powered by WHYY and you. Smart. Local. News.
Pennsylvania Ballet supports WHYY. Handel's world-famous Messiah comes to life on stage as Pennsylvania Ballet presents this triumph in music, drama, and dance. Featuring the Pennsylvania Ballet Orchestra and the Philadelphia Singers, Messiah is a feast for the senses and the soul. Handel's masterpiece, Messiah, presented by Pennsylvania Ballet at the Academy of Music, March 8th through 17th. Tickets at paballet.org or 215-893-1999.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. We are talking about sugar, actually talking about sugar additives and processed foods and how, according to our guest, that has led to a dramatic increase in the number of chronic diseases. And he is Robert Lustig, a neuroendocrinologist and obesity researcher, co-author of this article that appeared recently in the science journal Nature titled The Toxic Truth About Sugar. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I do want to get some callers, but just a couple more questions from this article. You go. You say that sugar should be removed from the list of generally regarded as safe GRAS list. And this is the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. They decide, I guess, what's safe and what isn't. You're saying remove sugar from the safe list?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's the single most important thing that can happen. The FDA can really set the table for change, and they tried to do it with tobacco. You know, that was David Kessler's contribution to you know, our public health. And I think that it's time to reevaluate sugar. The bottom line is that the last time this was looked at was 1986. This was before the advent of all this high fructose corn syrup. Mm-hmm. This was at a time when our total sugar consumption was half of what it is today. And the results back then suggested that there was a problem, but that the results were, quote, inconclusive, unquote. And so the, you know, not to, you know, tick off the food industry too much, the FDA basically continued the generally regarded as safe designation for sugar, which had first been given to it in 1958 when GRAS first came about. I think it's time to revisit that question. I know that right now the FDA has no interest in doing so because, you know, nobody in government is pressuring them to do so.
Well, and just to underscore that, when something is on that GRAS list, generally regarded as safe, that means that manufacturers, according to your article, can use unlimited amounts of that food in food.
That's right, exactly. And indeed, that is exactly what has happened. And if you take a look, for instance, you know, the Environmental Working Group, EWG.org, published recently a list of all the cereals, you know, 84 cereals and the amount of added sugar. And there are some that are 56% added sugar.
Wow.
And that's pretty disgusting. Well, and the bottom line is there's no, and you know, this is a cereal that kids eat. It's Honey Smacks, if I can name it.
You can.
Fact, so I hopefully no libel. But the fact of the matter is, you know, why is this allowable?
Well, and if people are at the supermarket, and, you know, we generally go to the supermarket once a week, why not just buy then sugar-free food?
Because you can't find it.
There's not enough of it?
There's not enough
choices?
There are 600,000 food items in America, and of those, 80% of them are laced with sugar. Bottom line is we don't have choice. People talk about me being, you know, a proponent of the nanny state, but the fact of the matter is we already have the nanny state because we've already been told what to eat. Because that's what's available.
You call for taxing food that has sugar, I guess, as a way to make it less attractive?
Well, let's put it this way. In our paper in Nature, my colleagues Laura Schmidt-Clairbrindis and I offer a bunch of different possible suggestions.
Right.
And we're not, you know, I'm not in the business of knowing which suggestion would be the smartest, best. What we did was we took the biochemical and social similarities between tobacco and between sugar and alcohol, and compared them. And the fact of the matter is, sugar and alcohol are extraordinarily similar in almost all of their characteristics. And after all, it makes sense that it should be because, after all, where do you get alcohol from? Fermentation of sugar. It's called wine. We do it here in Napa and Sonoma every day. In fact, the only difference between sugar and alcohol is that for alcohol, the yeast does the first step of metabolism, called glycolysis. And for sugar, we do our own first step of metabolism. But after that, they're the same, and they cause the same diseases. So what we said was, all right, let's look at what has been successful in terms of alcohol control policy worldwide. And, of course, the thing that pops to the top of the list is taxation. Taxation has a lot of advantages. Number one, it doesn't cause market distortion. Number two, it's very easy to implement. Number three, you can do an excise tax or a user tax. An excise tax meaning you tax the producer, you know, before it gets to market.
Right.
There are several things that make a tax very advantageous. How can you subsidize a food on one end and then tax it on the other? That make no sense? Indeed, I agree, that does make no sense. So the question is, would removal of the sugar subsidy, the corn subsidy that makes high fructose corn syrup, would that be effective? And we looked at that question and ultimately decided that that was not going to be the big difference. It would really not change prices significantly. And also, if you ended up increasing the price of junk food, that would actually be more of a problem for the poor because they don't have access to real food.
Sure.
They have food deserts.
Exactly.
And all they have is junk food. So they would not be consuming less because they couldn't get anything else. So until we find a new business model and a new paradigm for food distribution in this country, removal of subsidies did not seem to make sense to us.
Well, and picking up, and I realize your book has some suggestions. I guess I can use that word.
Well, but it's an article,
and it raises.
I have written a book. It will be out next year.
Oh, okay.
It will be called Fat Chance: Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease.
Okay.
If I can plug it, but it's not out yet, and right now we just have the article.
Well, and fair enough, and the article raises all sorts of very important and provocative issues, but you also seem to say that if you treat these sugar additives like alcohol, then you would prevent minors from buying food that had added sugars.
Right. Let's put it this way. A kid, a 15-year-old, walks into a convenience store and says, I want to buy a can of beer. The cashier says, show me your ID.
Right.
Why can't a 15-year-old walk into a convenience store and say, I want to buy a can of Coke, and have the cashier say, show me your ID? If a parent wants their kid to have a Coke on the way home from school, let them buy it for them.
And are you saying that a sugary Coke, and I know there's a lot of sugar in Coke, that's as potentially dangerous as a can of beer for a 17-year-old?
Absolutely. Now, the can of beer, of course, will cause car accidents, and, you know, sugar does not is not metabolized by the brain, so it does not have the acute alcohol toxicity, but it has all the chronic toxicities that alcohol does, including the fatty liver. We've already done 2 liver transplants on 400-pound 15-year-old soda drinkers.
Oh, wow. And some schools have done this, which is to remove the fast food machines and the places where you can get sodas. It sounds like that would fit very neatly with what you're suggesting here.
Yes, but it has to be done correctly and has to be done properly. Let me give you the antithesis of this whole argument. It's called chocolate milk.
Oh.
Okay. So, is chocolate milk good or bad?
Well, to me, it seems like a mixed bag. But you set me straight.
Okay. So this is a huge argument that's going on right now. The question is, when you grew up, how old are you?
I'm 63.
63. All right.
I'm really old.
Well, I'm getting there.
Okay.
When I grew up, and when you grew up, we had whole milk in schools.
We did. I remember.
And we all drank it, and it was perfectly fine. Then in the 1980s, we went to skim milk because the dietary fat in milk was a problem. And the bottom line was that the kids stopped drinking the milk because the milk tasted like crap. Skim milk tastes awful, and everyone knows it. And the food industry, the Board of Ed of every city in the country basically said, how are we going to get their kids to drink their milk because they need their vitamin D and their calcium? And so they basically hit on, well, let's give them chocolate milk or strawberry milk. Mm-hmm. They flavored milk. The bottom line is, when you look at the calories and the composition of that milk, it is basically a glass of milk and a half a glass of orange juice because of the added sugar from the chocolate. The question is, why couldn't we go back to regular milk?
Yeah.
Because the sugar was way worse than the fat ever was.
And because it's a different kind of sugar. It's not fructose, right?
Well, it's
lactose.
It's lactose corn syrup. Well, milk sugar.
The milk of
lactose.
Our childhood, yes.
That's right. That was lactose. And that is not a problem because the galactose is converted to glucose in the liver almost immediately. So milk sugar is not what we are talking about. We are talking about added sugar. We're talking about the sweet stuff.
I do want to get to our callers, but just picking up on something, and I had asked you about the added calories to our diet, but I'm also thinking, you know, portions are larger now, plates are larger. From my childhood, I remember small dinner plates, and now they're much larger than that, usually filled with food. People are not as active as they used to be. Is that also factored in some of the concerns you have about our overuse or dependence on sugar?
The question is, are all of those issues cause or effect?
Exactly.
That's the question. And there are some people who think it's cause, and I'm going to tell you right now that I think it's effect.
Really?
And I'll tell you why. Let's do a little experiment right now, you and me.
Don't ask me about my age again, okay?
No. All right. You eat 2,000 calories a day. You burn 2,000 calories a day. You feel good, normal day.
Right.
Are you going to gain weight, lose weight, or stay the same?
Stay the same, I'm sorry.
Right, because you burn what you eat, nothing to store.
Right.
Okay, now let's do the experiment. I'm going to put an IV in your arm. And every time, I'm going to follow behind you, and every time you reach for food, I'm going to pump you full of extra insulin that you didn't want or need. I'm going to over-insulinize you, like what we do to our type 1 diabetics. You know, not on purpose, but it happens.
Right?
So this is the new Marty. You're going to wake up in the morning, and you're going to start out the day eating 2,000 calories, just like you did before. Except now, because of the insulin I pumped you full of, 500 of those 2,000 calories are going to be diverted from your bloodstream straight to your fat. Because that's insulin's job. Mm. Insulin's job is to take energy and move it from the bloodstream into your fat tissue for storage. So 500 of your 2,000 calories, straight to fat, right off the top, like what the IRS does to your paycheck. Gone before you had a chance to spend it. In this case, gone before you had a chance to burn it. You are now 500 calories heavier. If you stood on the scale, you would weigh a seventh of a pound more because of what I did to you. Now, you ate 2,000. But you lost 500 to your fat. How many calories do you have left to burn?
1,500.
Right, but your body wants to burn 2,000 because
right.
That's where it feels good. And how many calories you burn and how good you feel are synonymous. Things that make your calorie expenditure go up make you feel good, like exercise, caffeine, ephedrine, it's off the market. Things that reduce your caloric expenditure, like hypothyroidism, starvation, make you feel lousy. So you now only have 1,500 calories to burn. How are you going to feel?
Yeah, not so good.
Not so good. And so what are you going to do? Eat back the 500. So now you're eating 2,500 instead of 2,000. Except, haha, I'm still pumping you full of insulin. There go another 100 of those 500 off to fat. Now you're 600 calories heavier. You're only up to 1,900 to burn. You still don't feel great. You're certainly not going to exercise. So you go to a doctor, you go to a nutritionist, you say, Doc, every time I get on the scale, I don't understand. I'm fat. Why am I fat? And the doctor looks at you and says, I know why you're fat. You're a glutton and a sloth. You eat too much, you exercise too little. And it's true, you are. But it's not because you chose to. It's not because you want to. It's because you have to.
Well, and let me just jump in, and then I do want to get our callers. But when you're following behind me and you're pumping that insulin into me, that's what processed foods are doing, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. In the paradigm, I'm doing it to you. And in the real world, it's the processed food that's doing it.
So going back to something you said earlier, so if we just ate, right? I mean, there's that phrase, you know, eat food small. I forget what it is.
Right. Michael Pollan's
argument.
He says, eat food, not too much,
right.
Mostly plants.
Exactly.
Seven words. I'll make it easier.
Go ahead.
Three words. Eat real food.
Okay.
Eat real food. If it came out of the ground or if it came from an animal who ate what came out of the ground, you're good.
And that's Robert Lustig, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about all the sugar that has been added to our diet and the fact that it's led to some pretty deleterious health effects. In fact, chronic diseases are now a serious problem, not just here in the U.S., but around the world. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Patricia from Graduate Hospital to join us. And Patricia, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes, I'm calling because about a year ago, my sister and I took our mother to see a neuropsychologist, and she diagnosed my mother with probable Alzheimer's. And then in a follow-up appointment when it was just my sister and I talking with her, asking about what we might do for our own health to avoid the same fate, the doctor said that we should avoid sugar.
Wow.
But she didn't talk about, you know, the sort of biochemistry or neurochemistry or whatever it is that's going on there. And so I thought maybe your guest could speak to how sugar impacts the brain and dementia and all of that.
Thanks, Patricia, for the call. Robert Lustig, go ahead.
Well, very good questions. And I will tell you that all of the data on this is very early. The data on sugar and Alzheimer's right now, today, is correlative, not causative. So I'm a little bit loath to sort of expound on that in public, but there is data, and there is concern, and there's a major concern. Basically, insulin resistance appears to affect neurons in a way that we don't quite understand yet, but it alters energy metabolism within neurons. And this is work that's primarily been done in rats by a group at the University of Washington, Suzanne Kraft and Diane Figlewitz. In addition, we think that sugar alters mitochondrial function, and mitochondria are really important in neurons because they don't have any fat stores, so they have to burn what comes in. And we think that fructose may alter mitochondrial function in the brain. And we know that the energy state of the proteins that ultimately fold on themselves, that cause the plaques that cause Alzheimer's disease, is an energy-dependent process. So if your neurons don't have enough energy, it can start that process. That's our best guess right now as to what might be going on.
Patricia, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Robert Lessa, going back to this eat real food, and I'm thinking about the diets that we grew up with. Are you saying that, and I'm thinking about that cup of coffee I have in the morning where I put some sugar in that.
Yep.
What do you think is the proper amount of sugar that we should have in our diet?
Very simple. The American Heart Association in 2009 published a paper called Dietary Sugars and Cardiovascular Health. I helped co-write that. I subscribed to our recommendations in that paper. Currently, the average consumption of sugar in America is 22 teaspoons per day. That's 450 calories per day in added sugar. And the article argues for a reduction to 9 teaspoons a day for men and 6 teaspoons a day for women. So that's basically a reduction by two-thirds to three-quarters of our current total consumption.
And people can do that without feeling deprived?
Oh, absolutely. You know, this whole question about deprived has a lot to do with this addiction issue and
right.
What's going on in the brain. And the point is this a good thing that we're all addicted? We have to basically unaddict people who have gotten addicted. And I'll tell you that it's the biggest problem that I have in trying to take care of children with obesity is the fact that the parents are addicted. So when I tell them that the first thing they have to do is get rid of the sugar beverages in the house, you know, they say, well, I can't do that because, you know, this is for me.
Mm-hmm. And we're almost up on a break here, but when you talk about addiction, you're talking about the kind of withdrawal that comes from giving up an addiction.
Absolutely.
The physical withdrawal.
Absolutely. Now, sugar does it itself, but, you know, sugar is also laced with another compound that we know causes withdrawal. It's called caffeine.
Mm.
So, you know, soft drinks are the biggest issue, and, of course, you know, everybody understands that, and it's the thing that everybody's been focused on in terms of childhood obesity and disease and taxation. But the fact of the matter is sugar does it on its own as well, so you don't need the caffeine per se.
Well,
but caffeine makes it way worse.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation and our callers. We are talking about sugar, the added sugar to our diet, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Robert Lustig is our guest. He's a neuroendocrinologist and obesity researcher, and he is affiliated with the Child Health Program at the University of California in San Francisco. We'll be right back.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY and is committed to delivering comprehensive care in an environment where respect, compassion, and quality come first. To learn how they help make lives better every day, chestercountyhospital.org.
Media suppression, corruption, and the murder of critics have marked the regime of Vladimir Putin, who's running for his third term as president in Russia's election next week. Despite mass demonstrations, he's expected to win. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Russian journalist Masha Gessen, author of The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A church in Georgia starts a job networking ministry to help people who are unemployed and hundreds show up. Also, the new CD from jazz drummer and composer Jack DeJohnette. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
WHYY programming is supported by the teachers and education support professionals of the Pennsylvania State Education Association, educating all children for a bright future. We are PSEA, providing the power of a great education.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Robert Lustig about an article that he and two other authors wrote in a recent edition of the science journal Nature. The article titled "The Toxic Truth About Sugar: Added Sweeteners Pose Dangers to Health That Justify Controlling Them Like Alcohol." It's a topic for today's Radio Times, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Why? Let me see what Mary from Little Egg has to say. And Mary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Hi, Dr. Lustig. I just got back on the Weight Watchers program, and that program underwent a big change in that fruit is now 0 points. We are all celebrating that we can have bananas and stuff with abandon. But I was talking with a friend who said, well, that means you could have fruit all day long and not count it on this diet. Isn't that too much sugar? So my question for your guest is there such a thing as too much fruit in its natural form in a diet? Could we get to the same point that he's talking about with his processed sugars?
Mary, I appreciate the call. Robert Lustig, go ahead.
You've actually asked a very loaded question, and I'm sure you didn't mean to, but this is a very complex thing. I do not want to be known as somebody who comes out against fruit in any way, shape, or form, because ultimately, in terms of the panoply of choices in the store, you know, fruit is so much better than so many others that I don't want to, you know, give the listeners the impression that fruit is a major problem. However, there are some reasons to be concerned about the total amount, there are some evolutionary studies done in primates, and there are also some things that we're doing in terms of looking at the total diet of the world based on the Food and Agriculture Organization statistics database, linking that to the International Diabetes Federation database. And we see some very clear issues about too much fruit. So I'm not real excited about saying that in public, you sort of, you know, asking directly. I think that fruit is so much better a choice than virtually anything else in the store, you know, particularly any processed food, that I don't want to come down on it.
But if
I think fruit is one of those things where I would say everything in moderation.
Well, and if Mary's saying, can I have an apple and a banana and a pear in a day, would you say?
I think that's fine.
Okay. But I'm also thinking about, you know, tropical.
Lots of fiber.
Lots of fiber, and that's obviously very important. But I'm thinking about tropical climates. You know, tend people in tropical climates, that's where a lot of this, the fruit grow, the people tend to eat more of that stuff. The fact that we can now get food from all over the world, has that sort of complicated our evolutionary metabolism?
Oh, absolutely. The fact is that we, as human beings, really only had sugar 1 month a year. It was called harvest time.
Right.
And then what happened after harvest time was 4 months of winter. So, in fact, the sugar that we consumed during that 1 month of harvest time actually increased our adiposity in a way that was beneficial and adaptive, given that we were now, you know, about to face 4 to 5 months of famine. The problem is now, with sugar being available 24/7, 365 worldwide, and that the total sugar consumption has just gone through the roof everywhere, which is the point of the article, and very specifically for the food industry's purposes, that we have basically undone our evolutionary biochemistry in a very negative way. What we have now is maladaptive.
Well, and what you say and what you blame is the Western diet.
Yes. Well, the Western diet is the sugar-rich, fiber-poor diet, and very specifically, sugar for palatability, which means sales, and fiber for shelf life.
Let me get back to our callers. So we have Sean from Ardmore joining us on Radio Times. And Sean, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you guys? Thanks
Good.
For taking my call.
You're welcome.
Well, I'm a huge advocate in this whole ban against sugar. I mean, I think it's essentially legalized cocaine killing.
I'm not for banning sugar.
I'm not strong on it in that, but I think my biggest, and when I say sugar, I mean like the stuff you can buy in a pound's worth in the supermarket. But I think the biggest problem that you're going to find, and I'm sure you know already, is shut down a giant the conglomerate. I'm not saying this word right, but
The sugar industry?
The big sugar companies. You know, how do you, they have huge influence in politics, and
they do.
They're just huge. I mean, it's become our life, and it seems impossible to get out of.
Well, Sean, let me see what our guest, Robert Lustig, has to say.
Sure. I couldn't agree with you more. In fact, the sugar industry has enormous clout, enormous power in Congress and at the level of government, and really around the world. They have so much power that I will tell you a quick story. In 2003, the World Health Organization put together a technical report. It was called TRS 916, where they basically labeled sugar as the biggest problem for global health worldwide. And that report never saw the light of day because our Health and Human Services Director, Tommy Thompson, had his assistant, William Steiger, write the nastiest letter to the head of the World Health Organization, basically extorting the $406 million that we normally pay into that organization, saying that if that report was released, we would basically not pay in. Mm-hmm. And the report was deep-sixed. So they have a lot of power.
Sean seemed to be calling for outlawing sugar, and as you said, Robert Lustig, that's not what you're calling for.
No, I'm not. We tried prohibition with alcohol. It
right.
was a dismal failure. The bottom line is we have to learn how to peacefully coexist with it, the same way we've learned to peacefully coexist with tobacco and with alcohol. And we learn a lot from the tobacco and alcohol literature and what's worked for tobacco and alcohol control policy in order to basically apply it to what's going on with sugar. And prohibition is not one of the potential items here, not at all. The point is we have to find ways to make sugar less available, less interesting, less seductive, ultimately the way to do that, as we have with alcohol, are things like taxation, restriction of access, certainly keeping it out of the hands of children, particularly as they come out of school, so potentially we could reduce the hours of being able to sell sugar beverages to children so that it's not at school times, things like that.
And you are an obesity researcher. You're also a professor of clinical pediatrics, and you're seeing this epidemic of childhood obesity?
Oh, and more importantly, childhood metabolic syndrome.
Right.
Obesity is one thing, but the fact is no one dies of their obesity. What they die of are the diseases that are downstream of the obesity, the type 2 diabetes, the hypertension, the dyslipidemia, the heart disease, and like I said, the fatty liver disease, the cancer, the dementia. Those are the things that chew through the healthcare dollar, not the obesity per se. And it turns out that every one of those diseases has been linked to sugar consumption, not just in a correlative way, but in a causative way.
So you can be obese and healthy?
Absolutely. 20% of all obese people have completely normal metabolism and will live a completely normal life. Conversely, 40% of thin people have the same diseases of metabolic syndrome. They're just not obese. So this affects way more people than just obesity. People want to say, oh, I'm thin, I'm protected. Garbage.
Garbage. And you're saying it because you need to look at how the body is processing all the sugar and look at insulin levels.
Exactly.
Let's get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499, 1-888-477-WHYY. And again, Robert Lustig is our guest. He says sugar is toxic, and we're talking about what to do about that. Let me see what Mike from the Northeast has to say. Mike, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello, Marty. Hello, Robert. And thank you, Marty.
You're welcome.
Great show, as usual.
Thank you.
And I just wanted to clarify, Robert, from my perspective, it seemed as though when you were talking about foods that are available in the supermarket that there just aren't any without sugar.
And 80%. 80% are laced with sugar.
80%
so there are
of food.
A few.
Okay.
But I guess what I was thinking, I grew up pretty much as a sugar addict and learned about what you are speaking of now. And when a person walks into the supermarket, they need to spend their time more in the fruit and produce aisle and the meat and the dairy aisles, the healthy food, and you can eat a very healthy diet, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and not have it laden with sugar. And I guess I wanted to more clarify, and even from your perspective, Robert, that when a person does go shopping, there are so many alternatives very healthy eating.
Fair enough, Mike.
Absolutely.
Thanks for calling in. Yes, Robert Lustig, go ahead.
Couldn't agree more. The bottom line is, when you look at a food in the store, it either has a nutrition facts label or it doesn't. And I would propose that what we should be doing is eating the foods that don't, because those foods don't need one, because there has been no processing. Food processing is the real issue here. That's the thing that causes the problem.
Mm.
And again, I would pose that it's because of the addition of sugar and the reduction in fiber. That's what makes processed food. Fast food is fiberless food, very specifically because you can't freeze fiber and because it takes longer to cook. It takes twice as long to cook brown rice as it does white rice, for just that reason. And up till now, you know, being able to freeze fiber has been very, very difficult, as we talked about earlier. So the food industry has learned, you know, through experimentation and also because of the low-fat directive, that this is their best way of being able to sell food, and they are doing a great job of it. The question is, if nobody was hurt by it, who would care? The problem is, loads of people are being hurt by it, and it's chewing through the entire health care expenditure portfolio of the entire country. Bottom line is, Medicare will be broke by 2024.
Because of this?
Will fix it.
Because of what we've been talking about?
Because of what we've been talking about.
About these chronic diseases.
That's right.
Have you looked at cravings? And as you're talking, I'm thinking about those moments when, you know, I crave chips, or I drive by a fast food place and, you know, I smell the grease and the French fries and all that kind of stuff, and I want it.
Well, yes, you do. And it's an issue, isn't it?
It is.
Well, the fact is that there is an addiction paradigm. The fact is that the area of the brain called the nucleus accumbens, which is the reward center, has these proteins in them called dopamine receptors, D2 receptors, and the dopamine receptors are the same for every substance of abuse. They're the same for nicotine, cocaine, amphetamine, cannabis, ethanol, heroin, morphine, and, sadly, sugar.
Hmm.
And so if you're addicted to one thing, it's likely that you're going to be addicted to another thing. And pretty much everybody who stops smoking and starts eating knows this. It's called addiction transfer. Oprah liked to talk about this a lot when she was still on the air. And the fact is that pretty much everybody in America is addicted to something. And so it's not at all surprising that the food industry can basically hop on to this biochemical evolutionary mechanism in our brain to exploit it to their advantage.
But does that also explain why when countries become more affluent, they tend to appropriate this Western diet?
Absolutely. Well, the fact is that the Western diet is cheaper than what they have. And, of course, they like it more. So, yes, that is exactly the case. And it's even worse in developing countries because they don't even have access to potable water. But, boy, they sure have access to soft drinks.
Mm. And is it also, we've been focusing on sugar, but I'm thinking about that sugar-salt combination. Does having the salt there impact
right.
the sugar?
Well, salt increases the salience of sugar, certainly. In fact, sugar hides salt, you know, like honey-roasted peanuts or Chex Mix. The fact is that sugar hides pretty much every other taste. It hides sour, like the Swiss Reserve that they put in the German wines because it's too acidic. It hides bitter, like milk chocolate, right, because caffeine's bitter. It hides umami, with sweet and sour pork, that's half soy sauce. You wouldn't eat that otherwise. So the bottom line is you can make any food taste good with enough sugar, and indeed the food industry does. So they know what they're doing. Now, are we addicted to salt? There is a little bit of data in animals that suggests that there might be some brain changes due to salt.
Hmm.
But the majority of the human studies do not support that. In fact, I take care of patients who have obligate salt loss from diseases of salt retention, something called congenital adrenal hyperplasia.
Hmm.
And when we get the medication right, even though they've been consuming salt like crazy their entire lives, when we get the medication dosage right, their salt consumption goes back down. So we do not believe that salt in and of itself is addictive. We think it can actually be, it's a salience issue, not an addiction issue.
That's interesting. Have you changed your diet after all this research that you've been doing on sugar?
Well, I was never a big sugar guy. I've got my own issues.
You've got your own issues.
Caffeine's my big issue. I'll tell you right now, if you take my coffee away from me, I'll kill you.
right.
But Sugar was never a big issue for me, but that really is neither here nor there as to why I've gotten into this field. I didn't enter this field with a preconceived agenda. I actually came in through the back door. I was taking care of kids with brain tumors at St. Jude Children's Hospital in Memphis, and the overwhelming majority of them were extraordinarily obese, and we tried to figure out why that was true and what we could do about it. And through that, we learned that insulin was the big problem. And when we looked at what was causing the big insulins, it turned out it was the sugar. So I came at this purely from a scientific standpoint, not with any preconceived agenda.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much, Robert Lustig, for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And he's a neuroendocrinologist and obesity researcher and co-author of an article that was in a recent edition of the science journal Nature, the article titled "The Toxic Truth About Sugar." He's also a professor of clinical pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology and director of the WAY Assessment for Teen and Child Health Program, and that's at the University of California at San Francisco. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder, along with Jonathan Best and Emily Bryant, our intern. I'm Marty Moscoe, and thank you so much for joining us, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.